What better way to celebrate Cinco de Mayo than with the latest edition of the Pipeline podcast presented by John Deere. Matt Wehmeyer in today, and we've got a full house. We've got our two Pipeline gurus, as always, Jonathan Mayo with Jim Callis, and our special guest today, MLB.com national correspondent Jesse Sanchez. And to all three gentlemen, thank you for joining us for today's Pipeline podcast. And Jesse, want to kind of start with you because the topic today, the top 30 international prospect list, which can be found right now on MLB.com. And Jesse, when we're talking top 30, talk about the players that are eligible to make this list and players that are not, and the reasons that they're not, and kind of what went into making this top 30.
The international signing period, you know, it's obviously one of the most important times of the year for major league teams. I think some teams, general managers, you know, they compare it to, you know, the first-year player draft. That time, they compare it to July 31st, you know, the start of free agency. And basically, international signing period starts on July 2nd, and it runs through June 15th of the next year. It's for teenage players, 16 years old. And this is where teams accumulate their talent. You know, they stock their systems in hope of trying to grab the next Miguel Cabrera or Felix Hernandez. But a lot of times what they're doing is they're filling their system with minor leaguers. It's their opportunity to be aggressive. Our top 30 international prospects list is made up from players from all around the world. I mean, from Cuba, Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Mexico. And this year, as in most years, there are going to be several prospects eligible to sign from, you know, places like the Bahamas, Aruba, even Germany. I mean, there's Russia, South Africa. I mean, tons of players registered to become eligible to you know, be signed their international signing period, whether they do or not, to be determined on how scouts view their ability. But it's an international event. It's a big time in baseball, and obviously viewed as something very important.
And Jesse, as you just rattled off all the countries that are involved with this process of formulating a top 30, I mean, we're talking really the cream of the crop here in terms of international prospects, literally all over the world. And I think that the consensus number one guy on the top 30 list is a guy, or I should say a young man, who's, if he's even that at this age, he's been scouted since he was 13 years old. He's now 16 and only been 16 since February, I believe. His name is Kevin Maiton. And Jesse, from what you've written about him and said about him, this guy has all the tools to become a real, real standout player.
You know, there's tons of praise been heaped on Maiton. I mean, people have said he's the best international prospect to come out since Miguel Sano with the Twins, and I think we see what kind of success he's had so far and, you know, what he's projected to have. They've compared him to Miguel Cabrera coming out of Venezuela. I've even heard people say, you know, he has the potential to be somebody like a Chipper Jones. You know, he's a power-hitting switch hitter. He hits well from the both sides of the plate. You know, he has a good glove, strong arm. He plays shortstop now, but at 6'2", 165, I think they feel he's going to get bigger. And I don't think anybody's going to be surprised if he ends up at third base. People just love his baseball IQ, his makeup. He is, you know, what scouts like, what international scouts like, what front office people, you know, fall in love with. At the same time, I guess you got to keep in mind, he's still 16, and a lot can happen between now and 18. A lot could happen between 16 and 17. So these are just projections. And, you know, they're high hopes for guys like Maiton, but I think people really see the tools there, and they just hope he turns into the player they, you know, they wish he can be.
And Jesse, how much of a bonus do you think Maiton's going to command? I mean, I think it's been kind of a open secret for a while. This is a guy who the Braves have their sights on. It sounds like, and I think for a while, that the people have, you know, figured that the Braves are going to be the team that lands him. How much of a bonus do you think he's going to wind up commanding?
You know, I mean, reports out there he's going to command somewhere near $4 million. I mean, I can't confirm that, but I think that's been written there, and that's kind of the buzz. I think we'll find out more actually on July 2nd when he actually signs. But I think that's kind of the range people are talking about, the 3.5 to 4 or maybe just a little bit over 4. I mean, that's a lot of money, and the Braves are going, you know, he's been linked to them. Several reports, several publications have the Braves linked to him, and maybe that could be true. And if so, you know, they're really a team like the Braves or anybody's really investing a lot of money in this young man.
Jonathan, yeah. To you, is there a guy, you know, we talked about the amateur draft coming up in June, you know, domestically, of course. And is there a guy that scouts are in love with with that group of prospects, are they heaping the kind of praise on anybody in the United States that scouts are heaping on internationally to Kevin Maiton, do you think?
No, I don't think there's that guy this year in terms of the all-around tool package. Jim, if feel free to disagree, but I don't think there is that jump out at you toolsy compared to all-star kind of player in this year's draft class, and at least not that I can see. You know, it's hard to compare. Especially if you're trying to compare a 16-year-old to a 21-year-old college junior, but I don't see that kind of praise being heaped upon anybody in the draft class.
There's nobody with that potential type of bat who's an infielder in this year's crop. I mean, maybe the closest would be Delvin Perez, but I think there are questions about his – I mean, he has the upside. He has some upside. Like, there are questions about his bat. There's nobody in the draft who combines Maiton's offensive potential and the ability to play the infield. There just isn't that guy. You know, the best college infielder would be somebody like Nick Senzel, and his power is not nearly as good as Kevin Maiton's.
Yeah, I don't think it's – because it kind of leads to a question I had. And I don't even know if there's an answer to it. Obviously, teams have been very active on the international front, some more than others. Some blowing past, the bonus restrictions and incurring penalties, and we can touch on that in a minute. But and maybe this is for Jim and Jesse and for me to consider. Do teams look at a draft class and say, well, boy, this year's draft class isn't so good, so we're going to be more active on July 2nd? Or is that too much comparing apples to oranges there? And do they just look at year-to-year, say, international classes where, okay, next year's international class isn't so good, so we're going to go nuts this year and not worry about next year?
I've talked to, the international scouts. They're obviously just focused on doing their job and trying to get, the international talent. I've talked to some of the domestic guys, and they have their focus on, the domestic side. But I have had a chance to have some conversation with some GMs and assistant GMs. And they tell me it's all part of the same, it's another piece in a puzzle. They're connected. And I think, I don't know if you really separate one or the other. I think they're there to complement each other. I don't think you can get all the talent from the international side. And I think there's also the belief you can't get all of your talent from the domestic side. I mean, if you look at a team like the Padres this year, as we all know, they traded tons of prospects when A.J. Breller came over there as a general manager. They traded tons of prospects. I think what they're looking – the Padres are going to be very aggressive on the international market this year. And the word is what they want to do is, sign as many top international guys, be aggressive as they can, and take advantage of all the picks they have in their draft and just restock their system. So I think teams like the Padres, and I think other teams probably use a similar strategy. They just use this as an opportunity to kind of complement each other, bring their system back up, and we will see. We'll see. I mean, there is a lot of projection here. Even taking college kids, taking high school kids in the draft, how are they going to plan out? And taking 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds out of the international signing guidelines. I mean, you really don't know how they're going to play out and how long it's going to take for them to develop. But I think, a team like the Padres and other teams probably just trying to, grab from both sides and, get back on track.
Yeah, and I would say just to follow up on that, I agree with Jesse. I don't think it's an either-or where you necessarily, look at one crop being down and go to the other crop. I just think the penalties are so different for going over your bonus pool in the draft versus internationally that they get treated differently. In the draft, you go over by more than 5%, you start forfeiting first-round picks. Nobody's done that. I don't think anybody's ever going to do that unless it's some kind of clerical error or somebody fails a physical and it screws up the signing late. And teams pretty much spend to their pool. You can spend the $100,000 on guys without penalty after the 10th round, and so some teams are a little bit more aggressive down there. But teams pretty much spend to their pool for the most part, and if they spend under the pool, it's usually because a guy failed a physical and didn't sign, whereas internationally, the penalties are more slap on the wrist where you know, you could, if you go over your bonus pool by a certain amount, you can't sign players for more, an individual player for more than $300,000, if I'm correct, Jesse, I think for the next two signing periods.
Right.
But at the same time, if you load up 1 year, it's kind of like you're front-loading it. Like, okay, I'll maybe step back for the next 2 years, but I'm going to go crazy in this present year. And if I'm not mistaken, I have hard enough time keeping track of the draft, Jesse, and I can't imagine trying to keep track of international. But there's 10 teams, I believe, right, that can't sign a guy for more than $300,000 this year because they've gone over their pool one of the last 2 years. By my count, was it the Angels, Blue Jays, Cubs, Diamondbacks, Dodgers, Giants, Rays, Red Sox, Royals, and Yankees? Does that sound right?
Yes. Yeah,
and then the crazy thing is, when you were talking about, you know, the guys on your list are subject to the signing pools. Now, all those teams, they can go nuts for Cubans who aren't subject to the signing pools because I believe they're, what, 23 years or older, and they've played at least 5 years in Cuba's top league. All those teams can spend whatever they want on a player who's not subject to the signing pool. So even though the Dodgers spent an unbelievable amount of money last year, we may still see the Dodgers go crazy for a Cuban prospect who isn't subject to the pools. And I know I'm getting off the track here a little bit. The Cubans on your list, namely, you know, I think your top two guys are Vladimir Gutierrez and then Lazarito, are they subject to the July 2 rules or can they sign before then?
They were declared eligible. Vladimir Gutierrez, he's a guy who defected from Cuba in 2015 during the Caribbean Series in San Juan. He was declared eligible to sign July 7th of last year. So he's actually been eligible during the last period. So I think he's, you know, if he doesn't sign before, you know, June 15th, he's going to sign during the next period. So he's actually eligible to sign right now, but under the international signing guidelines.
And what about Lazarito? Can Lazarito sign now?
You know, Lazarito is another guy. He could either sign during the current international period that started last July 2, or he can wait until July 2nd. And that all depends on, you know, what teams are available, what teams are over the pool, how much do the agents for Lazarito value him? Can he go, you know, do they feel like he can maximize his opportunities if they sign him now with teams like the Dodgers, who are still in play now but won't be in play during the next period, or they feel like there's going to be another club who's going to sign them. So, I mean, it's pretty interesting. Those two guys, they're eligible to sign. I mean, they're eligible to sign right now. But I think the feeling is they're still kind of examining their options, see if it suits them better to sign during the current period or during the next period. And I guess ultimately, the broad thing is, you know, they're under the international signing guidelines. You know, they fit under the scope. Of these bonus pools, and they're just trying to figure out, you know, what's best.
And I guess it's, you know, a lot of that comes down to two. Like, if I'm a team like the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Rays, and my pool is, you know, I can't pay a guy more than $300,000 once the next signing period starts. I'm trying to sign these guys now if I can make it happen. How good are those two guys? I know they're number two and number four on your list, and Gutierrez is the top pitcher. Can you give us a brief scouting report on both those guys? Because they both sound very, very interesting.
Yeah, Vladimir, he's a little bit farther along. He's 20 years old. He had a case recently in Clearwater. You know, a lot of scouts went down there. And what they were telling me is he was throwing in the low 90s. 91, 92. I think he hit 94 at times. He had a pretty good curveball, you know, 76 to 78. I think he added a change and a split. I think there were some scouts were telling me, obviously with the young pitchers, he could still use some better command. He's still working on the command there. But I think he's the kind of guy teams feel he's probably a couple years away. You know, he'll be 21 in September. So they feel like he's the guy who's, you know, might be closer to the major leagues. I mean, I wouldn't say he's major league ready. Like, as with most Cuban players, they're going to need some time, you know, to get used to playing in a minor league, to get used to that level of competition, get used to the travel, and then got to keep in mind all the other things that come on outside of the field, just adjusting to life in the United States. But I wouldn't be surprised to see a guy like Vladimir Gutierrez 2 or 3 years away, you know, maybe getting a cup of coffee, just a sniff in a big league, and or maybe sticking around. But he's a really interesting guy. Lazarito's a little bit farther away.
He's a young guy, 16 years old, but he has all the tools that, you know, scouts really like. I mean, the body, everybody describes it to me as like a
college football free safety. I mean, he's really built. And I had some good conversations with him in the Dominican Republic recently. And, you know, he is what they describe him as. He is a physical specimen. And I think over the past few weeks, over the past month or so, he's been working specifically with a trainer down there named Javier Rodriguez, who's trained some big leaguers, Yasmani Tomas, a bunch of these Cuban big leaguers. And they're working on refining his swing, getting it more under control. Lazarito is a fascinating talent. I mean, there's also the backstory where he signed with Culture 39. The owner of that is Charles Harrison, the cousin of Jerry Harrison from the famous Harrison family. Harrison stopped representing him because he said one of Lazarito's investors, someone who basically pays for everything that Lazarito does, housing, clothing, all this type of stuff, threatened him. Next thing you know, Harrison resigns as a representative. Octagon steps in. You know, there's some kind of conflict there. And I think a funny thing, Lazarito, he has his own, I think he has his own logo. I think they wanted to start a clothing system, you know, a clothing design, clothing line for him. So the Harrisons still own a part of that, if that ever, you know, takes off. But so there was just a whole lot going on with Lazarito. I mean, I think he's kind of been under the radar the past few weeks, maybe over the past month and a half or so, to get back to baseball, to get back to not being, you know, this guy who's going to have his own design team, get back to being the guy who's not going to be, you know, in front of cameras all the time, just get back to baseball. And it's going to be really interesting to see who signs him.
Jesse, that tension aside, you know, it seems that there are more Cubans on this list than in the past. I'm curious what, you know, when you're talking to all of the Latin American scouts you do, with the easing of some overall tensions between the United States and Cuba, do people see that opening up more, there being more of a pipeline from Cuba, and how quickly do they see that, you know, that floodgate opening?
You know, I mean, you know, the Cuban market has had a big impact on, you know, on the international, from, you know, international directors all the way up to GMs. They're paying attention. But the reality is there's still a lot of political hurdles before, you know, U.S. and MLB is free to sign players right out of Cuba. So what that means is, you know, Vladimir Gutierrez, Armenteros, you know, Lazarito, Jonathan Machado, all these guys on our list, they defected, you know, either, you know, through a tournament or late night escape. They defected the same way Jose Abreu did. So in that way, things haven't changed. I think in the future, you know, I went down to Cuba in December for the MLB Goodwill Tour and went back for the Rays, you know, play the national team in March. And what I saw there was like kind of an opening of dialogue between MLB and like the Cuban Baseball Federation, you know, trying to understand each other, see what each other wants. I think from MLB's perspective, they're kind of seeking an easier path so these Cuban players don't have to escape, defect, deal with human trafficking and all these kind of, you know, elements that, you know, nobody really wants to be associated with. And from the Cuban perspective, you know, they want some compensation. They want to be compensated. You know, I talked to several guys over there and several officials in the Cuban league, and they say, hey, we raised this kid. I trained this kid. Then he leaves and I get nothing. You know, that's not fair. So they're trying to work on some compromise there, but ultimately it comes to the issue, how it's going to be resolved is between the two governments. So it's one of those things that's bigger than baseball. So I think from a baseball perspective, you know, younger players are going to come through because they're all the established older guys are already in the big league or they're already in the minors. So when Cubans come over, they're going to be the young ones. So guys I talk to a lot, the international scouts who deal with the 16-year-olds, who deal with the 17-year-olds, you know, they're waiting for these Cubans to come over. And at the same time, they know, you know, not much has changed on that regard. I mean, there's been some changes between the government and, you know, Cuban government. But as far as baseball perspective, you know, they're just these guys still have to defect, and they're just kind of waiting on this young crop to come over.
Jesse, I know that, you know, traditionally when there's a hot prospect there for the taking, an elite talent, you know, most GMs, or they'd walk barefoot over broken glass to get to these guys. But for all the reasons you just outlined, especially with the Cuban players and all the baggage and the potential headaches that could come with acquiring somebody from that nation, is it getting to a point now where most teams, or not most teams, but some teams would even say, it's just not worth it, and there's so much more talent outside of Cuba that would cause less headaches for us to acquire. Does the stuff with Cuba and with the governments and all the things happening outside of baseball in a broader scope, does it in a sense scare away some of these GMs?
You know, I'm not sure if it scares away. I think some GMs and some organizations are probably better at navigating through the paperwork because they have a better understanding of, you know, the process, the residency, you know, where these guys are going to work out, filing for free agency, the issues that are going to come with the future, whether it's going to be, you know, a work visa, a visitor's visa, trying to get the families over. I mean, there's definitely a lot that goes into it. And I'm not sure if it scares away some GMs, but I think everybody understands there's a lot of work dealing with Cuban players and Cuban prospects. And maybe some don't want to, but ultimately I think if the player is good enough, if you know, teams or organizations, they feel like a guy is worth it, they will go through it. But there's definitely extra steps that, you know, an extra, I wouldn't say characterize them as headaches, but just a lot of extra steps that these guys have to deal with the Cubans, at least initially as far as, you know, background signing, residency, and tons of paperwork and all that. Again, it goes back to if a player's good enough, you know, scouts and teams and general manager are in the business of acquiring talent, so you kind of have to go for it.
And talent, yeah, I was just going to say, Jesse, I mean, talent's talent. And, you know, guys I've talked to, I mean, I think there's some sense that these guys are starting to get pricier than everybody could have imagined, perhaps. But you look at how good a guy like Jose Abreu is, or Aroldis Chapman, or Puig, or Cespedes, or you look at Yoan Moncada, who got a $31.5 million bonus from the Red Sox last year, and they had to pay matching tax, and how good he has looked, especially since the second half of last season. He might not be in the minors for much longer than a year. You know, plus, I think the other thing, that I don't think we're going to see demand for these guys really diminish, even if the supply increases, is that if you're talking about, again, you know, guys who are 23 and have played 5 years in the Serie Nacional in Cuba, and they're exempt from the bonus pools, they're the rare amateur player that you can spend whatever you want for. You can't spend whatever you want on a drafted player. You can't go nuts in the draft like you used to be able to. There's limits. Internationally, you can go crazy for a year, but then for the next two, you're going to be limited on what you can spend. But if they're, you know, especially if you're talking about a Cuban who's not subject to the bonus pools, you know, I could have maxed out my draft pool, my international pool, and be limited who I could sign internationally for 2 years, and I can go out and sign a guy for $50 million if he's from Cuba and he's 23 years old. So yes. I think even as the supply is probably going to increase, I don't think we're going to see a lessening demand. We may see a correction perhaps in the market price if some of these guys don't pan out. But you know, just from talking to people, and I don't talk to nearly as many people as you do, Jesse. You know, like you said, you can't just ignore the Cuban market. I mean, there may be a lot of red tape and a lot of adjustments that need to be made. You know, once they get here, not just baseball wise, but to a new culture. But any GM or team that's just saying, "Well, I don't want to deal with Cuban players because it's a headache," well, they're making a mistake because it's too talented to ignore those guys.
Yep, I 100% agree. And we will see how, as we go forward. I remember having a conversation with Commissioner Manfred in Cuba, and one thing, he was very optimistic about some type of change as far as the way Cuban players are signed, and whether and that was going to be something that was discussed during the next collective bargaining agreement. So we're going to see there. I mean, as you mentioned, everybody is taking notice of, you know, Cuban players, how they're signed, the prices. This is definitely not something you can ignore. And it was something the commissioner even addressed that, you know, he said he was going to work on a way, or the union, MLB, is going to work on a way to define how Cuban players are signed, you know, what, and I think they're considering the market, all kinds of things going into that decision. But it's obvious that, you know, Cuban market isn't something you can ignore. And basically, if you do, you're not doing your job. I mean, I thought it was about, you know, acquiring talent and kind of filling up your system.
What do you brought up the CBA there, Jesse. What do you think is going to happen in the new CBA? I mean, people have been talking about a possible international draft. You know, obviously this new system, or the current system in the current CBA, which was different, you know, there was no pool or limits in the past, is radically different than what it was. But it's not really, I don't think anybody's thinking this system's working the way they intended. When you're having teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox and Dodgers spending tens and tens of millions of dollars in penalty taxes and not really minding to go out and sign talent, do you think we'll have an international draft that will have everybody subject to it, you know, including the Cubans, or do you think we'll adjust the pool system? I know from talking to draft agents, there's some thought that, you know, the MLBPA made a lot of concessions on the draft in the last CBA, the amateur draft. Those guys are not their constituents. It's not a hot-button issue for the actual players who are members of the union, and they got other things in exchange. And the thinking is that if MLB wants, you know, major change internationally, that they will, give, you know, the union will give that up in exchange for something else. What are you hearing on that front?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I know the guidelines for signing Cubans under the international guidelines have changed from, like, you know, now they're at 20, you have to be, you know, 23 and under 5 years. Before, I think it was under 5 years of service at the top league in Cuba. I think before it was 3 years, so there have been some changes. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, I don't think the system has worked out the way it had planned with the Cuban players and, you know, people going over their bonuses and paying the penalty, and it appears to not to worry too much about it. I mean, Commissioner Manfred, he's been pretty open about wanting a single entry, you know, type of thing for all players. And I think there's mixed reviews in Latin America regarding that. I think some, you know, trainers are concerned, you know, what that will do to their pay cut for these guys that they train if everybody's subjected to, you know, a single entry type of thing. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people in Latin America that say, well, that's great. You know, let's get paid like the domestic guys are paid, whatever that is. Let's get scouted like the domestic guys. Let's get treated like the domestic guys. And, you know, fair pay is fair. You know, and, you know, it's a really hot topic in Latin America. You know, every time I go to Dominican or Venezuela or anywhere there, you're asking me, hey, what do you hear about the draft? What do you hear? Is there a draft coming? You know, everybody's freaking out about a draft. And then there's other people who say, you know what, it might not be such a bad thing that everybody's treated fairly and everybody goes in, you know, the same way.
Well, gentlemen, it should be a fascinating summer, no doubt, first with the amateur draft in June and then the beginning of the international signing period on July 2nd, as we just broke it all down, thanks to Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, and Jesse Sanchez, our special guest today on the Pipeline Podcast, presented by John Deere. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you soon.